Good morning. Welcome to another week in the life of people who are making meaning in the lives of students around the world, in your communities, next door, and who knows where, as we seek to learn online. And I'd like to share with you a little bit of my adventure. In 1996, I was hired out of maternal child health to run an internet startup, which in itself is a really interesting, strange thing. And I was tasked to find out what this online community stuff was. So I was searching on the internet, this brand new, spanking new internet, and I found this thing called Electric Minds. It's being set up by a guy named Howard Rheingold. Now, Howard Rheingold is the guy who wrote the first book on online community. And so I thought, well, I'll check it out. And I logged on and fell down the rabbit hole. I entered into conversations that I was not having in my 5 a.m. to 7 p.m. workaday world with two middle school boys at home. I was engaged in a way to connect with ideas and thinking and people that I had not experienced before. I was in conversations with a journalist from NYU. I was in conversations with a professor from Israel who would talk to me about philosophy as well as telling me how the citrus trees were blooming on his desk in his apartment in Tel Aviv. And when I had problems in my life, they had ideas to come in and support me. It was amazing. I'm going like, how can this happen? I felt like I was truly connecting with people. I was connecting at many levels, my heart, my mind, everything. And then Howard lost the funding for Electric Minds. And he said, well, I'm going to close it down around, you know, probably April 1st. And we all went, no, you can't take our community away from us. Now, this was Howard's business venture. He had wanted to do it both for reasons of the heart and reasons of the pocketbook. And so he was ready to let it go and move on, and we were not ready to let it go. So he pointed to two of us, one who had a lot of offline community building experience. I've been doing community building all my career. And another guy who was a coder, who I wouldn't say was a community organizer. So we decided to set up governance, and we were going to figure out how to get a new platform, and we were going to figure out how to get new software. And we failed miserably. I wasn't used to failing as a facilitator. I was not used to being reviled by the people with whom I was having these wonderful conversations. I was not used to this. I'm going like, how can it be so good and how can it be so bad? What is going on here? And from that day on, I have been devoting myself to understanding this practice we call online facilitation. And I'm going like, why does it work sometimes? Why does it fail other times? And over the years, I have heard teachers, as they've moved to online, share a similar story. Moments of glorious success and absolute abject failure. So framing with this practice is, so I was thinking about how to frame this talk. I was at yoga. I like triangles. I kind of did something that teaches to go into our pose, and I'm not going to do it all the way because just in case I fall over, that's really embarrassing. And she gave me just a little hint about how to move my hips. And the whole experience of triangle pose change. And I thought, that's it. That's the practice of online facilitation, which is there's a lot we know, and then it's a little adjustment in the moment in the practice. It's not something that can be reduced to a checklist. A checklist can help us remember, but it doesn't help us improve our practice. So today I'd like to suggest a metaphor of yoga. How many of you here do yoga? Wow. That's an incredibly high proportion of an audience. So if you don't like it, you can just stand up and do some meditation. Bring me back. Yoga is also about landing on your mat. There's this expression, when you get to yoga, you're supposed to let go of all that stuff. And I've got one of those heads going, by the way, if I start talking too fast, somebody give me the slow down signal, because I can start really talking. I get really excited. And this makes me go much better. And I can actually do an hour keynote in 13 and a half minutes. But that doesn't usually achieve the goal of sharing an idea. So please feel free to tell me to calm down. So back to the mat. Back to calming down. I am my most successful at online facilitation when I focus on it. These tools allow us to multitask, and we're going to play with multitasking today. So there's times when we need to stop and focus to reflect on the practice. So that's another way to share the metaphor of yoga with you. I'm still trying. There we go. So today, I also want to move myself further on my edge of yoga. You know, the teacher also says, where's your edge today? Your edge today may be, I can barely get out of bed. Or your edge today may be, you're going to do one of these really twisted up poses. I'm going to put myself on my edge today, and I'm going to use something new. I'm going to try a new tool. I'm going to try and role model what it means to introduce a new tool and think about the facilitation aspect as a second layer of our exploration of the history and future of online facilitation. So I'm going to invite you to jump off the edge with me. I'm going to be using a set of tools that were created by Timo Elliott from SAP, and it's lovely. I learned about these tools from, sorry about the crunching when I move up and down, from Keith Atkinson's book called The Back Channel. Cliff Atkinson. Cliff called me about a year ago and asked me to tell stories about my use of the back channel because I use it extensively in my work, not in presentations, but in group work. And so he sent me the book about a couple months ago, and I finally got around to reading it, and I decided I would learn something from Cliff and use it today. So Timo, he pointed to Timo's tools, and Timo works for SAP, a business, and he has to put up a disclaimer in order to give away his tools for free. And I thought about the conversation yesterday about Facebook, which is you have organizational constraints and you have opportunities that you want to try and do. And Timo found a way to do both. He put a disclaimer. Is that disclaimer kind of a lawyer-y blah, blah, blah? Yes. But it enabled him to do something risky and generous in an environment where there's certain rules and there's reasons for those rules. So he found a place in between, which to me is also an act of facilitation. Is finding the place in between the constraints and the opportunities. I wanted to thank Timo publicly as an act of reciprocity because one of the things that shows up in a constant pattern of usefulness in online facilitation is reciprocity. Now, typically we think of reciprocity as I give something to you, you give something to me. Online, what we notice is there's a type of reciprocity which is distributed. So I give something to you, you give something to someone else, something. And this pays off in a more networked manner. So, today, in order to live that reciprocity, I'm thanking Timo, and I'll show you how I'm thanking Timo in a moment, but I'm also going to give away my copy of the Back Channel book. I'm going to give away some copies of a book that I wrote with Etienne Wenger and John Smith. I'm going to give away one of my favorite facilitation substances, chocolate, and red wine. Now, this is Jim Groom's bottle of red wine, so we're going to practice this distributed reciprocity right here because he and I shared my bottle of red wine, but we didn't have the consumption capability of drinking both bottles of wine. So one of you may share it with many people and you'll have this distributed reciprocity, this idea of giving back. And Chris is going to help me do this. And in fact, I'm not quite sure how I'm going to do it, so that's part of jumping off the cliff. Because, you know, why do what you know is going to work? Why not learn something new? I guess, you know, if I would reframe my introduction, if I'm a chocoholic, I'm a mom, and I'm a learner. I love to learn. And learning is taking risks, so we're going to take these risks. So what I'm going to do today is, now here I have to go do a little something here just for a second. So this tool allows me to aggregate, remember Jim yesterday talking about the magic of aggregation, the tweets that have been tagged with the tag ITC10. So you see right here, I sent a tweet out a little bit earlier to my network to say, please join us. And as we share out via tweets, they can get a little bit of this talk that they might not have, that they couldn't because they weren't here. And they might bring in ideas that we don't have. So I'm just going to look here. A business girl who's on an airplane right now actually gave me some ideas for today. And she was hoping to tweet in, but she's already getting on the slide. So it's interesting to see here. I'm going to use this slide at four points along the top to stop and see what you're thinking. Now, we have to understand when we introduce a new technology, when we're facilitating the introduction of a new technology, that not everybody will adopt the technology in the same way. Not everybody will adopt it. If again you go to Jim's idea that we're going to learn in the cloud, the fact is that each learner may be using a different configuration or collection of tools, and we as the facilitator are like, oh my God, how am I going to handle that? We have to keep a line of sight on the variety of use. So I'm going to ask you to do something. If you have something in your hand and you want to set it down, okay, and I'm going to ask you, if you have heard of Twitter, please stand up and stay standing. And this is what Business Girl taught me yesterday. If you're in one of her workshops, then you're going to know this. Okay. So I'm doing that quick scan to see if anybody hasn't heard of Twitter. And it looks like everybody's heard of Twitter. I can't tell if there's anybody sitting down in the back. This was probably a backwards thing. I should have had those who didn't have said. Okay. Now, if you have Interest in learning about how Twitter can be included as a back channel, a way for people to contribute in a nonverbal way in a verbal conversation. Raise your hand. Okay, put your hands down. If you are concerned about the use of this thing in terms of multitasking or attention, in general, raise your hand. Surprising, I actually thought to see more hands there. If personally for you this is very uncomfortable, raise your hand. Thank you for being brave for doing that. So we have a really good range of use and adoption, potential and actual in the room. Now, those of you who have a Twitter account, remain standing, everyone else sit down. Change in the room? Yeah, if we had done this last year, it would have looked different. Okay. If those of you have used that Twitter account for more than 2 weeks, remain standing, the rest of you sit down. So we're seeing patterns of experimentation. This is really important. And in the curve of the technology, you know, you're going to have your early adopters. You're going to have those who are in the pattern of experimentation. But most of us are going to be here in either thinking about it or, you know, contemplation. Okay, those of you who have been tweeting at this conference, stay standing. Okay, notice another very interesting change. Now, those of you who are staying standing, I invite you to be active explorers in providing feedback via Twitter. Those of you who are sitting near those people and you want to put something into Twitter, you can ask them to send a message for you. So we can do peer learning, we can do side-by-side, over-the-shoulder learning. Thank you for standing up, folks. Go ahead and sit down. We have someone saying, hi, Mom. Let's just take one more quick refresh here. There we go. Still standing. Who is still standing? Ed! Where's Ed? Where did you go? All right, so he was tweeting while that was happening. So he clearly has that early adopter ability to do something and multitask. I think a really important message here about technologies is they're designed for a group but experienced by an individual. And therefore, we will not have the same experience as them. And therefore, cannot make the assumption that our learners are having uniform experience with the technology. And that also means then we have to think about different technologies. And that we'll come to that a little bit later. Oh, I know. This is where this little tool I have to go up here. I forgot. There's a special magic thing I have to do. So that was tweeting on. No, I'm just going to go to the next one. That was tweeting on the tag ITC10. So that was a Twitter that's aggregating around a topic. You could also tweet around relationships. So I'm at Nancy White, all one word, not Nancy underscore White. That's another person who's very interested in e-learning, and she's a librarian. I'm not Nancy White 123. I'm not Nancy White. There was some character on it. There's lots of Nancy Whites. Having a common name is very interesting on Twitter. So you can aggregate and follow a person. You can follow a theme. So all of a sudden, we've got a change from a historical group forming, which is about personal relationship, to group forming, which is around a theme or an object. So we're already seeing some of the stream of the history we're going to talk about. Now, some people worry about this risk of tweeting. That's what if someone says, oh, that Nancy White, I can't believe she said that. She's a It can happen. So there's two ways to approach this, technologically and through process. I'm going to do it through process today, and I'm going to borrow again from Cliff's book and think about the simplest, clearest agreement we can make. A set of 10 rules is too much for most of us to keep in mind. And for those of us who have that list of 20 rules that everything has to happen in this course, how many of them are your learners going to remember? One, two? Or they're going to say, it's that list I'm supposed to remember. So my offer to you is you think about tweet unto others as you would like them to tweet unto you. We recognize this one. It comes from someplace. And this is the time to give away the back channel book. Who would like the back channel book? Oh, God, I knew that was going to happen. Okay. Chris, you get to figure this out. How was that? Okay. See, he kept his hand up. Look at it. What's your name?
JJ.
Okay, now all of you who are looking at JJ and you live near him, you can ask him when you can borrow the book. Yeah. Or JJ can go on book crossing and when he's done reading it, send it on to somebody else. So we can do the reciprocity further. Way to go. I'm also sending out tweets using the same tool from Teemo that are built into my PowerPoint in the notes thing. There's a little bit of code. So as I'm talking, I have sent out a few key messages to my network so that I'm also influencing the Twitter stream in some way. So I am using a technological thing to try and focus on the content as a way of thinking about the back channel as a way to use different media to amplify learning. Some of us are good listeners. I'm not. I love to see the visual. I love to see the text. So a tweet actually helps me listen better than me simply, you know, kind of trying to listen and then start doing my email. I'm one of those bad multitaskers. So I'm also tweeting out. So if you're following the ITC Ken tag, you'll see every once in a while there's a tweet from me like, how can she teach? She's standing up there. Well, it's pre-pointed. So if I go off script, of course, my tweets are meaningless, and which is possible. Whoops. Online facilitation and how it shapes what's going forward. And what's very interesting is we think that a lot of this automatically happened, that we, you know, the internet arrived and all of a sudden we could do all these things, but there's actually a very interesting history, and every time I look back into it, I look further back and I discover the patterns that are informing our work today. Steve Wheeler did a really interesting series on his blog post about the history of distance learning, which I'll share a URL for that. In fact, I will be sharing all these URLs on a website, and I will give you that URL. I had it at the first slide. I'll give it at the last slide. But all the links, all the slides, people who contributed to my thinking via Twitter and my blog in advance, all that's there. So if you're worried about links, they'll come up later. But this magic happens through the intertwining of technology and people over time. And we stand on the shoulders of lots of history. So we think about the history of online facilitation didn't start with the first web community. It actually started with the ARPANET and people connecting computers. The history of distance learning goes back hundreds of years in learning through letters that were sent via the mail. The history of facilitation goes back even further, and what we know about online facilitation is, should be, considered as part of the practice. Now, what happens in offline facilitation doesn't mirror exactly what happens. It's this evolution and reapplication. And one of the things we saw early on in online facilitation was that people were totally ignoring what we knew about group practice. And this, if you build it, they will come. If you put up a web form, everything will happen. We know that didn't work. And if you think back, well, you know, what makes a group of people have a conversation? Here, it might be you're sitting around a table with five or six other people. You're in a human-sized group that's good for conversation. Or somebody asks a good question, and all of a sudden everybody goes, yeah, that's interesting. We didn't necessarily know that a lot when we started the first online community. These papers are very interesting reading, and if you're really trying to understand your own practice, they're a great way to reflect on it. And again, those URLs will be available later. I'd like to just quickly acknowledge some of the people upon whose shoulders I'm standing. And Peter and Trudy Johnson-Lenz, who did the Awaken.com project, which was looking at group process moving from offline to online. Murray Turoff and the STAR project, Roxanne Pitts and EIES. And these were very much business-oriented projects. It's very interesting. Most of the early research about the practice was in the business context, not necessarily in the learning context. Lisa Kimbold, Howard Rheingold, and Michelle Paradise all were looking at the social context. So these were the online communities, the salons, the conversational communities. Liz Reichert was one of the first people to look at it in terms of government consultations. And Jessica Litnack and Jeffrey Stamp looked at it very specifically from teams in any context. These are just a few names upon which we have built our practice. I went too fast here, but Twitter-wise, if you are on Twitter, think about who is the person or people that you learn from about online facilitation. And you might tweet those in there, and then we can go back and look at the Twitter stream, and I can see who you learn from, and I can see upon whose shoulders you stand. So this intertwining of community and technology has been going on for many, many years. It's, you know, when you think about, how many of you are old enough to know about the lines, what do you call those telephone lines where we all share a line? Thank you. So how many of you remember those? And you pick up the phone and someone was on it, and you're like, oh, get off the phone, I want to use it. It was like, you know, a connected community. There's some norms about when you got off, how you'd cut it in an emergency. There's all sorts of things that were developed in that practice. So Plato Notes, which was developed in order to help some programmers collaborate on their programming, started thinking about the discussion forum. These things emerged, and as they tried something, they go, well, wait a minute, I need to adjust that. Well, we need to thread it, or we need it to be linear. Does everybody know what threaded and linear is? Anybody not know what threaded and linear is? Brilliant, okay. If I use jargon, stop me, ask me. I sometimes forget. And it's hard to guess what everybody knows. Well, you can't guess, you have to ask. That's what facilitation is about, making it visible. So then we have the bulletin board services, Usenet, when all of a sudden people were starting to gather around a theme. So those early groups, again, were very socially oriented. We started introducing the idea of, I'm interested in Star Trek, or I'm interested in chocolate, and I will find a group and I will go talk about that thing. And then I'll form connections with people. Then it came into the internet, and we had this multimodality of images and click and move, and then we moved into the Web 2.0 era, which simply means the software had advanced to a point where us mere mortals could figure out how to set it up and use it with other people, so we were no longer dependent upon the geeks to get us going. And the adoption curve broadened, and more people began to participate. The idea that we could publish changed the experience of being on the web. No longer was it just a conversation, but I could represent myself on the web. So as an example of how this works, this is the posting statistics for the online facilitation list, which I started in 1999. And if you look at it, I think there's a pointer here. I never use pointers. They seem like really cool. In 2001, January 2001, that was one of the months when we had the most posts. I shouldn't be turning back and forth so the audience will get me. Then there's a drop that starts to happen around 2003, and a significant change from here. I started blogging in May of 2004 and stopped facilitating the list. I used to put resources in there and ask questions and stimulate the conversation, and I decided I was going to put it on my blog so it was more widely accessible. And in that period of time, we see a drop in the posting over time. But the drop in the conversation has actually not happened. The conversation about facilitating online has moved many places, and it's diversified. It used to be about online communities, which was conversation things. But then there's the e-learning people who split off, and the business people who split off, and the people who were interested in government and public input consultation split off. And the field diversified starting around 2001. And now these conversations are happening in many places. And this reflects what is happening to online facilitation. It is no longer centralized. It is becoming distributed. So let's see, let's do a stop.
It's time to test the Twitter thing.
So what was your first online facilitation experience? If you're on Twitter, would you put something in? Or if you have, I'm also going to, well, you're doing that, I'm going to look and see what feedback we've got so far. So let me put the hashtag in. I have to tell you, this worked last night, and then it didn't work, and then Windows updated everything, and I had to try and figure out why it didn't work again. So this was a perfect example of not knowing exactly what's going to happen. So we've got Matthew has, you know, we've got some people who are taking notes here. So as we look at the note-taking, think about your learning style. Do you notice something in this note that is something you might not have noticed? Does it affirm what you noticed? Think about the people who aren't here. Let's see, Sylvia Curry. Sylvia Curry is a colleague in British Columbia, and I'm going to refer, I actually did refer, to the scope history of online facilitation in that previous, you know, the back end of the slide. She is a fabulous resource for people learning to teach online, and the scope community is open to anyone, and it's a great place to learn very practical things about facilitating learning online. If you don't know about the scope community, that's one of the URLs you're going to want to get off of the wiki. Fabulous. CM Duke, where are you? We still haven't, you know, actually had a conversation face-to-face. We need to do this before I leave. Prodigious Twitter. And also, I noticed that you pick up things. You spot trends, amplify trends, or provoke with a thoughtful question. And that's a practice that helps us be more critical thinkers and be more engaged in the conversation. AJ, you've been tweeting throughout the whole...
they're close to each other. What does this mean? Are they tweeting in cahoots, the three of them there?
No. So Chris, you know, this thing about allows broader participation? Question mark. What do you mean by that?
He's going to tweet it. You can say it out loud. Two previous tweets that was continuing from. Does putting the tweets, the back channel on the big screen, reproduce the inhibitions we have? And this is a really good question, and one of the reasons I don't have a screen just with a back channel is for that very reason. And so this is actually putting a bit of a risk back onto people who thought they were tweeting in private. And this is the dynamic of public and private, which is an important facilitation dynamic. And the new tools are blurring the boundary where we thought. So a classroom is no longer a private conversation. It's being Facebooked out and tweeted out. And so what you thought was a bounded community is now a network. And if we're aware of that, we will think about our behaviors, or theoretically, we will think about our behaviors and make choices, rather than just assuming that it's a closed space. So that's a really good thing. Let's see. It's about damn time. Hugs. All right. Nancy has jumped into the tweeting world. Okay. Chocolate for Nancy. Where are you? Okay. Who wants to be Nancy's chocolate proxy?
No, she's not joking.
It's a retweet. It's a retweet. Okay. But Nancy Lunch is in the room, isn't she?
No.
I thought she was. Okay. You... She trusts Linda, okay. Still hoping, okay, Effigy 3, where are you? Okay, Effigy 3 gets another bar of chocolate there. See, if you take a risk, you get rewarded. Now the problem is, I don't have enough attention to pay all the attention to it, so I actually will go back and read the tweets afterwards, because I, as a presenter, can't do all that at the same time. But I'm getting a little bit of line of sight. Okay, Matthew is on the big screen. Matthew, where are you? How do you feel? Powerful. I'm breaking the wall between the presenter and the audience with this tool. I could also be intimidating. These are all possibilities. So when you think about using a tool, you have to think about the consequences and the facilitation of the tool. Okay, so now I forget I have to do this little thingy again. So next thing, technology has changed what it means to be together. So Sylvia Curry is with us right now in a small way. The person in Seminole County is with us today in a small way. We are with them in a small way. It used to be it could only be who was in the room. It used to be you could, you know, create a container, invite people into it, get to know each other, and do stuff. And now we may have simple, quick connections with people we've never met before, may have a meaningful and useful exchange of learning or ideas or whatever, and then we go on our way. Others, we may find this wonderful attraction, and we keep in touch, and we keep going. This change has actually challenged us significantly, because now we've got so many possibilities of being together, we don't know which one we want to do, and which is this idea of fractured attention and multi-membership. If I can belong to so many learning communities, networks, that I'm not going to meaningfully participate in any of them. So we're at a time now where we're quite challenged, and I think there's some issues around both practices and technology that are emerging from this new challenge of being together. What's happened and what I've noticed, and I wonder if you noticed in learning, is that initially we did mirror those, get everybody into the room, introduce them, and do this kind of sequential scaffolding. So if you look back to Jilly Salmon's scaffolding for e-learning, how many are familiar with Jilly Salmon's scaffolding for e-learning? If you haven't read her work, I would highly recommend it. If you look at her early work and you look at her work today, you will see a significant shift going from a sequential way of entry and engagement, introduction, the scaffolding for learning, that now looks like this. Is we go a little bit and figure it out, and then we come back. Because people are engaging in different ways. That different experience with the same technology has said we've got to move from linear models to more, what's that word? Cyclical models. No, not cyclical. Cycles, spirals, I don't know. There's a word for it, but it's this thing. You know that thing? Swirls, chaos. I've been working a lot in the field of complexity, and there's one part of complexity which is around chaos, and sometimes that's what it feels like. I think rarely actually it's chaos. So we have to think, and if we look at the offline facilitation here, offline facilitation, let's think of meeting facilitation, or planning a face-to-face course where you have a sequential curriculum. These facilitation processes work really well for bounded groups
of limited numbers. They don't scale out very well. But if we look at the facilitation in a more open environment where people come in and out or people go out and find things and come back in, a la Jim's model yesterday, we can also see parallels with the offline facilitation world in the embracing of tools like open space, where you basically invite people in the room around a question that matters and they self-organize an agenda and get the work done. Or the World Cafe, where you convene people around small tables, around conversations that matter. They own the process. You create a minimal set of conditions to enable something to happen. When we move into network learning, we're creating conditions because we cannot control it. And this is a shift in teaching and learning. We're shifting from something we can predict to something that we're actually guiding. We push a little bit here, pull a little bit there. David Snowden, the knowledge management person, who has some wonderful thinking about complexity, talks about amplifying what works and dampening what doesn't through a series of safe, fail, experimentation. Safe, fail, experimentation. That means, like I'm trying to tweet today, something that you explain what's going on, you take a risk together, if it works, you amplify it, if it doesn't work, you move on. But you don't invest in something so good that it fails catastrophic. Now, we look at e-learning, we can see this both in process and in technology. When institutions invest in something huge without understanding the consequences, the risk of failure is very high. So how can we also think, in a rapidly changing world, of more smaller, say, fail experiments, building into those bigger decisions rather than building the requirements of a software system, installing the system, and then finding out from a social perspective it doesn't work. And this happens. What happened to anybody here? You know, it's painful to invest at that level. So I'm suggesting that online facilitation in this world is safe, failed, small experimentation rather than building giant monoliths, because the world will change underneath your feet before that monolith is completed. That says we're in new containers. We can't just think of the classroom. We think of the goals, the learning goals of the course and how it taps into the world. We think about Jim's model yesterday of the individual. It's focusing and keeping everything around the individual versus thinking around the group. And the work I've been doing recently is thinking about the continuum between the individual, the bounded group, and the network. And some of the distinctions I make is the individual is about their own learning trajectory, their learning styles, what they need, what they want to do. It's about me, okay? It's all about me. The group is a bounded space where you're going to give up some of me in the service of me. There's a social contract or there's a work requirement contract. It's a contract to do something together and to move from point A to point B to point C somewhat together. Then there's a network where membership is less clear. I mean, you know, am I in, am I out? If there's millions of people, how do you know if you're in or out? We have intersections and overlaps of our interest rather than congruent interest or intent as we do in a community. When we think about learning this way, our institutions generally focus around the group thing. We try to enable individual, and we're beginning to understand how we can tap into the power of the network. And by thinking about these containers, we actually have a broader palette with which we can paint and design for learning online. And we need to think and discern when we want to focus on each of those areas or which blend of it. And I think this is another big shift because we had been thinking classroom. Our container was very clear to us before. Our container is different. A guy who's at Psych Media, what's Tony's last name? You know, I think the 51 is really a trip on the memory thing. Anyway, at Psych Media posted a tweet a week ago. He works for the Open University in the UK. And he said, what if we didn't think about degree first? We thought about what an individual needs to learn along their life. And as they acquire the things they need up to a certain point, then they get the degree. They don't go get the degree. They learn throughout their entire life. If they thought outside of a degree program, the opportunities for Open University to have a business model that really scales out, to rethink how they tapped into the network for learning and the internal resources of the institution, I went, wow, that's brilliant. You should do it. And he said, yeah. I don't know if Open University thinks we should do it. But this is the kind of thinking outside of the old container to understand the possibilities. And those of you who are thinking from an administration point for where e-learning is going to go and the facilitation of e-learning, try thinking outside of the old container for a moment and see what shows up. What kind of safe-fail experiment can you do outside of that old container? So as we come out of these containers, again, we have some the new things that are showing up. Velocity, the speed of things, the change of things. We have the replay of identity, and both Saturday and Sunday, identity came up over and over again, and we have to think of our identity as teachers and our identities as learners, our identities that are showing up in many more ways than we're used to having shown up in our face-to-face life, where we segmented our identities. How I showed up at church might be different than how I show up on the rugby field.
On the rugby field,
you know? Now there's these little traces of our electronic identity that float and cross over. And there's a project in the University of Reading in the UK, and the URL is not there, so someone might want to tweak the name. It's This Is Me. And if you Google Odin Lab, O-D-I-N Lab, and This Is Me, there's a curriculum for students about digital identity that's done on Creative Commons, and a bunch of us have remixed it. So now there's one for people who work in international NGOs. There's one being created right now for librarians. There's one being created for people who are not digital natives, shall we say. I don't know. Somebody told me that if you're over 35, you're a senior citizen online. I've been a senior citizen a long time. I don't know when that happened. It was kind of surprising. But this idea of thinking about identity is a critical part of facilitating online now, where it wasn't so much before I began. So this is one of the changes that I think is significant. The other change that's significant is we're no longer just teaching. We're dealing with technology, and we've become technology stewards. And this came out of the work of the Digital Habitats book. So I'm going to give away one of the Digital Habitats books. Now, who wants the Digital Habitats book? How about give it to one of the Tweeties over there in the corner. So you guys can hash it out with Tweety. You guys were like ready. Did you see that? It was like, you know, aerobic hand raising. I've got two more books too, so. I don't want to carry them back. Books are heavy. You know, I think blogging is wonderful. It isn't heavy. So when you go someplace, now you have to carry books. And laptops. I love blogging. I'm not sure I'll ever write another book again. I love writing. But anyway, technology stewardship. When we were doing research about how technology enables communities to continue to learn together, we discovered that there was this role, this function that was actually terribly underappreciated and really not talked about a lot, which was technology stewardship. And technology stewardship is a person who has enough knowledge of the community to understand its needs and enough knowledge of the technology to select, maybe configure, and steward the use of that technology with the community. It's not the IT department. It may be having a great relationship with the IT department. It is about knowing and being of the community or the classroom or the network in order to steward those technologies. And most of us got to this way accidentally. So how many here would consider yourself accidental technology stewards? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you want that job? How many of you didn't want that job? Okay, we got both. We're different. We're diverse. But the fact is, we can no longer ignore the technology. We can no longer hide under the lead-eyed bucket. We have to steward it. And stewarding technology for me is about friendship with other people who are a little bit better than I am at it. And sitting side by side, because there's a lot of subtlety to technology stewardship. It's not read the manual. It's, oh, how did you do that? That's really interesting. Technology stewardship is a practice that now is beginning to be described. And in the wiki, I have left some resources about if you're a technology steward. It's about how to consider what kinds of activities you're trying to facilitate and how the technology might fit with that. So in the wiki, there's a resource called the Spidergram resource. And if you are a technology steward, there's a link to that and some other free resources that come out of the book. So if they're useful to you, great. If you want to adapt them, great. If you have critique of them, even better. I always need critical feedback. This change in technology also means we're no longer text-based. So the early elements of facilitation was discussion boards, asynchronous text. How many are fast writers and readers? Then you know your text catalog. I can do amazing speed in text. But my students, I had a student and I was teaching online facilitation online, and I typically start each topic with about a three-quarter page intro. And she said, I'm drowning. I can't do this. And this is a really smart person. And she said, could you record the first openers of each of the topics? And then I can follow in the discussion. And so I just recorded and put it. So she said, you just changed my experience of learning with you by recording it. Now, I hate recording. I download podcasts, turn them on, and go do something else. I am not an audio learner, but I have to understand I cannot design for my needs. I have to design for the needs of the group as best I can. So again, technology designed for an individual, experienced by a group. The corollary is don't design just for yourself unless you happen to be facilitating a room of clones. And if you're facilitating a room of clones, it's probably going to be pretty darn boring. So think about how you move that. Now, somebody asked me on Twitter when I was soliciting advice, am I going to talk about Google Buzz? And no, I'm not going to talk about individual technology, but this is where I learn about new technologies in my network. People who are far geekier than I know enough technology to be dangerous. You know, and many people say I'm geeky, and on this side of my network, they say I'm not geeky. So tapping into those people and using my network, I'm letting them experiment with the tool, and then I'll jump in gently, because I cannot experiment with everything. So how many of you here today have heard of five more things that you can consider, and you're thinking, oh my God, five more things to look at? Do you have time to look at those things? Some of you do. Okay, who has time to look at those things? Raise your hand. These people should be in your network, okay? These people should be part of your community of practice, because they're the people who are going to lead the way. Now, how many of you are good, once everybody else figured out, you're good at figuring out the social stuff and that stuff? See, this is another really important skill. We can't all do everything. So instead of getting overwhelmed, we use the network to learn to increase our online facilitation skill. Doing a little time check here. Oh, look. So I mentioned Steve Wheeler's distance education piece, and I really suggest reading it if you're at all interested in the history of online facilitation, because Steve took the word distance, and he used that as a metaphor to examine how we've learned together online or at a distance. And we used to think of distance meaning we're not in the same room, but we're doing distance learning now in the same room. We're doing distance learning that bridges people who are different from each other, between gender, between nationality, between racial backgrounds, between techiness and non-techiness, between visual thinkers and audio learners. We are creating tools that enable us to decrease the distance between us to enable learning. And for me, this was a really wonderful insight. And when I facilitate, what am I doing to decrease the distance between the people who are learning together so they can actually make meaning together? Because some of our tools actually allow us to create more distance. And divergence is good for brainstorming. It's good for innovation. It's not so good for meaning making. We want to think about convergence for meaning making. So again, borrowing from offline facilitation, where in your e-learning is about divergence and getting into diversity, and where is it about convergence and finding what we have in common? And one of the things that's challenging when students are networking outside the classroom is having line of sight to their divergence. And so my approach has been to actually ask them to weave back in their own in-classroom reflections what has happened with the conversation outside of the classroom. So specifically acknowledge that there is a lot of divergence, so let's use it in our practice of convergence. So, another Twitter feedback slide. Let's see how this is going. I don't know how often to do this. I'm not quite sure if this is useful. So, maybe after you take a peek at it, we'll see, is this interesting? Is this useful, or should I go quickly past on? Oh, I got to put the search term in. I have the search terms all preset, but obviously that isn't working. Shall we improvise? Let's see that. Okay. So our Jim Groom has chimed in here now from a distance. Feel bad for leaving so early. He's able to give you feedback. How many keynotes get to walk in, give a talk, leave, and give you feedback? Furthermore, you can give me feedback. You can give me feedback. You can deepen a moment where you are actually have less power because of me having the mic up here to have more power in the conversation. Technology is enabling you to participate if you choose in a different way. Now, for those of you not on Twitter, do you want to say something right now? I'm not putting you on the spot, but I want to make sure I recognize that a small handful are actually tweeting. Would anybody like to say anything? Comment? Question? Tweet? Holler that loud, and then I'll repeat it back to the room. She can speak really loud. Okay, so just for the recording's sake, the age group she's teaching doesn't tweet. And so that's a really fascinating question, is then to understand why don't they tweet, And I think there is a lot of age differential and some surprising patterns around age differential of tool adoption. Like, my mother's on Facebook. Not to disclose personal things, but there's stuff going on in different parts of our family, and she follows all of it. And she picks up the phone and says, "Should I be worried?" You know, we have both some predictable patterns and some unpredictable patterns. Now, the question I would ask is, would the use of Twitter be critical to the learning experience? And if so, what would be an on-ramp to the experimentation of Twitter? If it's just an experiment, see, if they're using it, that's a say-fail experiment. You say, okay, this is not the tool for this particular group. But if you're trying to do something very intentionally with that tool, then you bring it in. And I would suggest the work of Howard Rheingold and his social media classroom. Again, somebody might want to Google this URL and tweet it because it's not on the slides. He has a series of wonderful videos about his work with students at Stanford and Berkeley. You know, we know these are smart kids. And quite surprising about some of their lack of knowledge of how to use social media. And the difficulty of integrating that kind of participation into the classroom. Because what Twitter is for him is participation. And what we're trying to do is engender participation in our learning, not passive, yeah, I'm going to do the test, you know? So he really has to work very hard to build participation, but he focuses it on the participation and not about the tool. The tool is the way to make visible the participation. So this is a beautiful example of facilitation is making a practice visible, and technology as a representation of that practice. So that's a really good question. And thank you for tweeting, and give her some chocolate. You're going to get lots of exercise, Chris, because, you know, she was in the very back. So. Okay, and my students don't tweet either. Attempt at filling the screen. Effigy 3. Brilliant. Effigy 3, where are you? Okay. Do you want chocolate?
Oh,
you got it. Okay, come trade your chocolate for... You trade up. Come trade up. Okay, now, the thing about the wine is, are you flying on an airplane?
No.
Okay. Because if you're flying on an airplane, you have to break it out tonight and share it with everybody before you leave.
Well, I don't drink.
Well, you have to break it out and share it with everybody anyway. And you got a great last name. So who wants the chocolate? Back there. Yellow shirt. I'm not going to throw it, though, because I'd hurt you. By the way, this is Italian chocolate. Not all of it's Italian chocolate, but this came from Italy just 2 weeks ago. Okay, I'm going to keep on moving on here because I have to make sure we finish on time so that you can make it to the next thing. So this gets us to the next wave, which we're noticing the emergence of new patterns of facilitation. So the example with Twitter is, how do I understand what's happening with what I want to achieve pedagogically and experience and participation, and how does it interweave with the technology? So this is not technology for technology's sake, which I know you know. This is very clear in the conversations I've heard in the hallways and the sessions. But it requires us to think about the technology in a different way and to imagine the possibilities of technology. Now, one of the things, again, in the research from the book was that we found that people use technologies in ways that were totally unexpected by their designers. So the whole at sign on Twitter, which is to direct a tweet to a person, came not from the designers of Twitter, it came from the users. And the designers said, oh, that's cool. So they built it into their protocol. Remember, I said that intertwining of community has changed what it means together, and community has also influenced technology, and technology influences community. And there's a slide for this someplace else, so I may have this in the wrong place. But okay, I'm not sequential. You may have noticed that. I'm not linear. I'm global. I drive linear people crazy. This interplay between technology and community is one of the patterns about rethinking how we do learning online. So there have been people who have been looking at this academically and looking through theory and research and understanding how the different theories of pedagogy are representing in this new environment. So I'm just going to flip briefly through some of these. If you're interested in the background of these new approaches to learning, look at the work of George Siemens. Again, Jim mentioned it yesterday with the MOOC, the Massively Online Open Course. I also think you have to say that with a low voice. I don't think it's the MOOC. That means something. So the MOOC, and some of the things that George has in his list of network learning patterns, amplifying and curating, wayfinding, aggregating, filtering, modeling, and persistent presence. If you look at traditional offline e-learning facilitation, amplifying, curating, Modeling and persistence of presence are very consistent to previous patterns of face-to-face facilitation. But this idea of wayfinding and socially driven sense-making,
does that mean?
It means finding the pieces and connecting them. Pointing people to resources. It's a different sort of thing. This idea of aggregating, particularly with the technological impacts, again, of syndication. Filtering because you have more content available than you need. And filtering is a critical network function that isn't present when we before this information age. The other ones, we actually know how to do. So our amplifying our practice with some of those things. Dave Cormier, who was tweeting earlier, and someone might tweet out to at Dave Cormier and tell him we're taking his name in vain. He always likes that. Has developed this more organic view of it called rhizomatic learning, which, you know those fungi that actually can go for meters and meters and meters under the ground, but you only see one or two mushrooms? It's when something happens that that mushroom is sent up, but this network lives underground. It's there, this idea of activating potential out of the rhizome. He also has adopted something that came out of the communities of practice research, which is also the community is the curriculum, not just this set of content objects, and that people make meaning by owning that curriculum. It's a radical way of turning what we have seen as traditional learning on its head. Clay Shirky, who writes about social media in his book Here Comes Everybody, talks about it from a bargain, a promise pool bargain perspective. So again, this would go back to your question about Twitter. Is, you know, I'll promise you that we'll do this if you use this tool and the cost benefits are this. And he really thinks about being more conscious about what we're trying to do with the technology in the social interaction. And his work in Here Comes Everybody is a very fascinating read if you read it from the context of e-learning. It wasn't written from that context. But it has some very thought-provoking things that could give us some fail experiments. So this means we have to learn new patterns. And this means that the practice of e-learning has fundamentally changed what it means for the practice of teaching and learning. And a big part of this is patterns of identity. I mentioned earlier, how are we fostering identity in people's lives? How are we fostering our own identity? Do we want to have an online identity? There's no choice anymore. You have one, whether you know it or not. There is some digital bit or byte about you out there, and probably more. So having to take that on. So our practices are becoming more complex, and they're also not fixed. They're always moving on. I guess we're doing this thing again. They're always moving on. In thinking about e-learning, it is thinking in a network way. So remember I talked about individual, group, and network? So now, what are the practices I have to add to my teaching that take advantage of the network but doesn't let the network overwhelm what I'm trying to do or what my students are experiencing? Again, this idea of discernment, of understanding what the network can give and when to plug into it and when not to plug into it. One thing the network can give us is scalability. You cannot scale a classroom. You can scale learning across a network. So if your goal is to provide affordable access, I heard, you know, when I heard the chancellor speak about the things that were important, sometimes that means affordable access may not mean a course or a class. It may be affecting learning in other ways or bringing the synergy of a network learning experience to a student who's in a classroom experience. This is about forming connections, about helping people develop strategies with overwhelm. And if we can't have our own strategies about overwhelm, then how are we going to help our learners? It's again, as Seaman said about scanning and filtering. So it is a very interesting practice. Now, if you look at the work of June Holly, she works with social networks, and she talks about the thing of network weaving, which is a matter of, they call it connecting the triangles. And one of the things that we've noticed about very effective in workplace learning has been triangulating somebody's workplace learning to an external network that can both support that learner, who's often a solo learner, and validate their work to their boss, who often doesn't care what the learner's doing because of hierarchical issues, time issues. So when you think about weaving some learner into the network, you're giving them the power to get learning from external sources, to have their own learning validated when they make their learning visible through blogs, as would be an example, not the only example. And then when this external network says, oh, learner X just did something fantastic, and the person that they're responsible to sees it, their value just went up. So you're creating patterns that a learner can then use when they're out in the workplace. This is lifelong learning. This is not just out of the classroom. So thinking about network weaving as a critical online facilitation skill in learning, I think, is a great way. Again, we don't talk about it in learning as often as we talk about it outside of it. So I'm curious, where can that conversation start happening? This triangulation also helps us from falling over. This is chair yoga. If we don't connect the triangle and observe when people are falling out, we lose learners. And I think this is still the biggest challenge about e-learning, and again, this completion rate issue that she raised. How do we keep a line of sight to people so they don't fall out? What triangle do they need to be connected to? And I think this is still a huge area of challenge for us. This is photography yoga. See, I did have the yoga theme in there, subtly, but it's there. It's about making things visible, and you've heard me talk about making things visible a number of times. I mean this both literally and figuratively. I mean, we should be using visuals. We should be drawing together online. You know when you see people go up to a whiteboard and start going, there's something about that kinesthetic experience that enhances learning. There are tools we can start doing that online. We can use visuals to break up graphics, and it changes people's experience of the material. So really thinking about it. But also there's this making visible of process, making visible of those triangles of connection. So really making visible is a huge facilitation pattern. So let's see if this one initializes. I might skip this one because let's go on to the end and get it more to a, we'll get it more to the end. So there's one more piece that's very important, and it's the last piece, which is we are now dealing with things that are always shifting underneath us. It's not either or, but it's a duality of finding the place in between at any one time. So again, discerning, should it be individual, group, or network? Should I be focusing on oral or text-based? Should I be doing this? And it's not one or the other. There is no set fixture of things that says we should be doing this. It should be a place that moves. So while I was teasing Jim about this yesterday, will blogs may be very individual-centric, do we need to have something there that is group-centric? How do we develop shared meaning versus individual meaning? And dancing with these dualities is the biggest change in the practice, because no longer can you learn to do teaching and assume a static path going forward. We're always going to be dealing with those dualities. So we've got Reverend Jim talk about individual, and yes, it's not just the individual. It's finding the place between the we and the me and that network. It's about looking at those different things that create learning. And there's two quotes that I think are just beautiful that bring this together. The first one's from Albert Einstein. The positive development of a society in the absence of creative, independently thinking, critical individuals is as inconceivable as the development of an individual in the absence of the stimulus of the community. How are we building both into our design and facilitation of learning? Power does not reside in institutions, not even the state or large corporations. It is located in the networks that structure society, Manuel Castells. Our universities, our colleges are not walled gardens where nothing is happening outside. It requires a more sophisticated and complex view of learning out in the world. We're balancing between communities and networks, between individual centrality, by that I mean really focusing on the social interaction, and object centrality, which is we're focusing on the topic, and we really don't care if we're having a conversation. Between pushing the information to people and asking them to pull, to deliver a lecture to facilitate a conversation, between controlling, understanding the academic bounds of our institutions and emergence for things that are still to come, between online and offline, and I suggest strongly that we don't think about e-learning is just online, that there's always an offline component in our lives. And that also, we have this, we go between glorifying one style or another, and performance and sage on the guide on the side are just meant as representations that, yes, there's still the role for that engaging moment of theatrics and telling fire and brimstone, and then there's the moment. And letting them do it. These are the dualities. Those aren't new dualities in many ways, but they're represented in new ways by mediated by technology. We used to think about learning as a stock of stuff. It's now a flow. What I learn today and what I need to learn tomorrow will change. It's no longer a set of courses that will launch me successfully into my career, but my learning into that life. It's about making easy iteratively, about adjusting things and experimenting and bringing that experimentation back to reflection. And I leave that with reflection. If we do not reflect on our practice, we will not move it forward. So what kind of conversations are you having about your practice of facilitating online? How are you adjusting in your practice? How are you changing? Because what changes is not everyone else. We cannot change our institutions by ourselves. We cannot change our learners. We can only change ourselves. And the place to start is here. You have the power to change other people only through changing yourself. That is my belief. You can say, you cannot believe that, but in action, this is where change happens. So our new skills are not necessarily learning Twitter. It's about understanding how to keep moving forward in our practice. And looking at that, there's some specific roles that have changed. We've amplified what it means to facilitate online because we're looking at more things. We're looking at how people discovered appropriate, useful technology, that technology stewardship. We have this a participation piece, which is how to be in and use networks and communities, how to express their identity in this new online world as learners, as people in the world, or whatever, and how to find and create content. I didn't talk a lot about content, but the creation of content is a very empowering thing. It's a great way to stimulate learning. And finally, how to participate in their own learning and in the world. So now we're calling on community leaders, on technology stewards, on network leaders, on independent thinkers to really bring the practice and move it forward. So we're playing on our edge. Remembering that edge is me tweeting is what can you do today that's right to move your practice forward. So for the final tweet out, I'd like to thank, and I'm going to also take the privilege we have, I want to talk to us. And I still have, I think, what, two books of chocolate. So
incentive.
I'm not beyond I'm not above bribery. What area that you want to advance in your own practice? So let's put this Twitter slide up. And you think for a moment.
Will this initialize it?
Initializing. Here we go. Let's put in search term. I am really a robot.
Come out to the keyboard. This sounds interesting. Okay.
What, out in the audience, what one thing do you want to change in your practice? Strategy is take on one new thing at a time. You know, we don't have to take on everything. So just so the question gets captured on the table, there's so many things, how do I deal with it? Take on one thing at a time, and the other thing is take it on with somebody else. There's nothing more magical than two people deciding to do something because, not about you, but I used to go walking with a friend, and I would never not show up for the walking with my friend. But when she wasn't in town, I wouldn't walk. So there's another part of that, is creating some mutuality in the learning with other people. Now, what's really cool is you can tap into the network. You don't have to just tap into someone geographically. So if you want help tapping into someone who knows a certain tool, ask me, or ask some of these early adopters in the room, because there are people who love doing that. Hand up over here, and come over here. Yeah? So do you want chocolate? Okay. Okay, so now she's on the prowl. Okay, so I want to get that on tape. It is a tweet map. Would you tweet the URL so that people could find it later for tweet map, which allows you to geographically find tweeters?
All your tweets
are
on a Google Map.
Yes. So put that URL in the Twitter so we can put it into the wiki. Or you can put it into the wiki. Fire. That's a brilliant comment, and make sure he gets reward is that new tools help us visualize patterns that we couldn't see before, and we can only hold so much in our brain. And these tools about visualizing this, you know, this kind of metaphor and the actual practice of making visual visible is incredibly important, and that's a good one. So my time is up. I want to thank you. I actually have two more books and some more chocolate, so if you're interested in it, okay, you got a hand over there. I don't know what to do when everybody raises their hand. Okay, so I'm going to trust Chris because I trust Chris, and she trusted to invite me here. So with that, I want to thank you very much. I welcome additional comments. I will respond to you on Twitter afterwards. Let me get to the last slide. We've got the wiki URL. I'm skipping this slide, but this slide was about calm and quiet is important too, and rushing around and trying every tool has its place, but also the time for reflection and quiet is important. But there's the URL. Also, I'll tweet them out. They'll be on the wiki, and I want to thank you so much for letting me play with you, experiment with you on my edge, and learn more about online facilitation with you. So thank you very much.